Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? I am super excited to bring you this interview with my friend Emmanuel Amazin, whose new book, Building Machine Learning-Powered Applications, just hit bookstores. In our conversation, as in the book, we explore how to approach machine learning projects systematically, from idea all the way to working product, including formulating your problem and creating a plan, building a working pipeline and initial data set, evolving your models, and deploying and monitoring them. These are the same concepts covered in a new study group we're launching starting this Saturday, February 22nd, around the AI Enterprise Workflow Specialization on Coursera. If you're an aspiring or practicing data scientist or ML developer, and you want to level up on the broader set of skills required to deliver models in business settings, I really encourage you to join us. To learn more about the study group, visit twimlai.com/AIEW, where you can catch a recorded session I held with Ray Lopez, the instructor for the courses. There, you'll also find instructions for joining the study group, which is totally free, and how you can get a free month of access to Coursera to boot. Once again, the website is twimlai.com/AIEW. For more on the interview and a link to the book, visit the show notes page at twimlai.com/talk/349. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Emmanuel Amazin. Emmanuel is a machine learning engineer at Stripe. Emmanuel, welcome, finally, I should say, to the TWIML AI Podcast. How are you, my friend?
Thanks for having me. I'm great. How are you?
I am doing well. So Emmanuel and I have known each other for at least a couple years now, maybe more. Yeah. We met when you were at Insight. You were responsible for the Insight Data Science AI program. What was your official responsibility? Because I've interviewed Ross on the show as well with Insight.
Yeah.
What was your official role there?
So I had a role very similar to Ross's. Ross was my equivalent in New York. So I was leading the AI program there. Mm-hmm. So we have a sort of professional education programs, fellowships in many different domains, data science, data engineering, and we have one in AI. And so I was leading that one.
And so usually we start these interviews by having folks share a little bit about their journey. Why don't you tell us how you got to Stripe and perhaps more importantly, how you got to being a published author. Congratulations.
happy to. So I started off, sort of, I think like many people in this field, my passion for ML started with Jeff Hinton's Coursera classes way back in the day. Okay. I feel like for most people, it's either Jeff Hinton or Andrew Ng that got them started.
Team Andrew here. Nothing against Jeff.
Yeah. And then after that, I started my professional career. I did data science at a startup in the Bay Area, which got acquired by Zipcar later. I spent 2 years there. And actually after that, I joined Insight. So after having been a data scientist, I joined a role that was much more about sort of like professional education and mentorship. And so for a couple of years at Insight, I mentored in aggregate, it was over 100 fellows that were PhDs and engineers that wanted to transition and get a job in like the field of machine learning. So that was amazing. And through my work there, I learned a lot about what it takes to transition and what it takes to build successful ML projects. A lot of that is in the book you mentioned. After a couple of years there, I wanted to go back towards something more of an IC role for me, more of an individual contributor. And so I went at Stripe because it sort of had the perfect blend of what I was looking for in a role, which was it blends very heavy and challenging machine learning with sort of very heavy engineering requirements, which I think is where the field is going in general. And so I wanted to do more of that.
We haven't mentioned the title of the book yet, but it is Building Machine Learning Powered Applications, Going from Idea to Product. When did the book become available?
The book became available last week.
Nice. And so I have one of the first copies of it right here in my hand, and it was signed by you. Thank you very much. So the book
You guys got this subtitle going from idea to product. Is it a conceptual book, a technical book?
Yeah, that's a good question. The title comes from, the desired scope of the book. So the desired scope is really to give tools to aspiring ML engineers and data scientists to go from sort of either a PM has an idea or you have an idea to you have something in production that is actually being used by real people. And it's a bit of a blend of conceptual and technical. It is technical in the sense that there are many code examples. There is a set of notebooks that accompany the book. And there's actually an entire prototype application that we build together throughout the book. And at the end of the book, it has a GitHub repo. You can go and try it out. But it's also conceptual in the sense that a lot of these topics are more about how you frame problems than just like copying code off of Stack Overflow. And so there's sort of interviews with data science leaders that have done this sort of thing. There's an entire section about like data ethics and how you think about shipping models and when you should and shouldn't. So it's a bit of a hybrid book in that sense.
Nice, nice. I flipped through it and saw some of my favorite folks in here, Monica Rigotti and Rob Monroe, and I guess we know some of the same people.
yeah. Small world.
One of the things that I noticed, and I haven't gone through in a lot of detail. I mentioned to you that like I literally just got this out of the mailroom here. Mm-hmm. But the structure of the book is that you develop a sample application, as you mentioned, and the sample app is predictive text. Mm-hmm. How did you pick that app for context?
Yeah, that was first of all, that's a really good question because that was one of the parts that I went over the most times and just changed my mind very many times about which application should be the running example. And in fact, mm-hmm. I had a conversation mm-hmm. with Monica Rigotti where I pitched her on one of my initial ideas and she told me it was a terrible idea and I should definitely not.
Oh, what was it?
I wanted to do something that was like, it would listen to politicians' speeches and then like compare with how they vote and tell you whether like what they were saying in their speeches sort of aligned with how they were actually voting.
Like a fact checker kind of thing?
Yeah, like some sort of automatic fact checker.
It would have been timely.
Right? It would have been timely. That's what I was thinking. But it would have also been pretty hard. The sort of reconciliation of what's true and like what's not true very quickly gets into the realm of opinion. And if you add sort of like the errors of a machine learning model to the nuanced worldview, it's like definitely one of those examples of apps that could do more harm than good. And so mm-hmm. Monica talked me off the ledge on that one. But
what were some of your other ideas?
Well, I considered doing initially sort of computer vision examples because those are always the more striking to sort of maybe newer folks to the field. Like it's, you know, an image is like a very powerful example. Mm-hmm. But
A thousand
words, exactly. But I felt like they were sort of overused and most ML tutorials are sort of some sort of like computer vision thing nowadays. So I wanted to do something different. And then I wanted to do tabular data because that's what I think what most people do in their day-to-day for most companies. But I felt like there was less room for a standalone product there. Like sort of like bring your own tabular data has less of a ring to it than like bring your own writing. So I ended up settling on NLP. And then I wanted to do something that was most ML products aren't just one model. Like they're not just, you know, like you have a model that solves your use case perfectly and then you just ship it. They're usually a combination of sort of heuristics and rules and models and engineering work. And so I wanted a product that reflects that. And when I was thinking of products that did that today, sort of writing and assisting people to write better is a crucial example of that where you can check for grammar, that's just rules, right? You can check for vocabulary or for a variety of things. And then you can also help them improve their style. And that's more of something that you can learn with ML. So it was a nice blend that sort of reflects what happens in the real world, I think.
So does that mean that somewhere in this book, there are lots of regexes?
No, we've chosen not to go down that path, but there could be. The book starts with very simple, so like instead of regular expressions, it's, you know, simple word counts that say like, oh, how many adverbs are you using? Are you using and a little too much or that sort of stuff?
And so what's the overall kind of path or structure through the book? And kind of more importantly, what does it say about the way that you think folks need to approach these kinds of projects?
Yeah, the book is broadly separated into four stages that I think generally make sense for most ML projects. And I think a lot of time people focus a lot on training models, and then you talk to experienced data scientists and you hear, right, oh, 95% of the job is sort of looking at the data and shipping the model, not really training the model. And so this book purposely sort of almost ignores training models. It just assumes that you can figure that part out with the many really good courses around. And so the four approaches are sort of, or the four parts are going from whatever your goal is, your product, you know, what your company's doing, what you want to do, to an ML approach and to a plan for that ML approach. Because I think at Insight and at Zipcar, I've seen just many projects fail just because it's the wrong ML approach. And if you had just chosen a slightly different approach, you'd be in a much better spot. The second step is sort of building your MVP. That's something that was definitely the motto at Insight. And I think that Insight applied very well, was sort of encouraging people to start extremely simple and build a full project before they go, you know, diving down the rabbit hole of research.
Mm-hmm.
The third part is, I think, one of the ones where I sat down with the most fellows over my time at Insight, which is like, how do you debug models? More often, like if your model is either not working or if it's working, but the performance isn't sufficient, how do you know what you should do next? How can you sort of take a deep dive into what your model's doing, what your data looks like to actually decide what you do in your next iteration cycle? And then the fourth step is sort of like deployment, monitoring, and the concerns that come with showing the real world to a model and a model to the real world.
Yeah, I am really appreciating all of the focus that kind of this real world ML and AI has been getting over the, I don't know if I would say past year, past couple of years. I mean, it's something that we've spent a lot of time focusing on and led us to produce the TwimbleCon AI Platforms conference last week to kind of talk to how folks in real organizations are tackling these broader problems. But even just over the weekend on Twitter, like I'm seeing tweets all the time, like, hey, it's not just about the model. It's not just about the model anymore. And there seems to be a kind of growing recognition that, you know, and not so much recognition, but more really appreciation that's the case, and that kind of the broader workflow that takes you from an idea or a problem identification to getting a solution in production is, you know, multifaceted and involves much more than just training up a model.
Right. And to be fair, right, it used to be that just training up a model was pretty hard, and maybe you needed a team of people that understood sort of the internals deeply. But now, because the tooling has evolved so much, it actually is the case that the tooling's so good and the courses are so good to train models that that becomes relatively simpler than the rest.
Right, right. Yeah, we're actually launching a study group in just a couple of weeks now. We do these study groups as part of our community where we'll do online courses together. And we've done a bunch of Fast AI courses and Stanford courses, but we're doing one starting with kind of an intro webinar on the 15th of February, and then continuing on after that on this AI enterprise workflow course that's really interesting. Unlike any kind of formal course, this is on Coursera. Unlike any formal courses I've seen, this one touches on a bunch of the things that you cover in the book. So, you know, how do you structure data collection? How do you kind of visualize and analyze your data in an exploratory mode and kind of test hypotheses? How do you identify data biases in the process of collecting your data? You mentioned using multiple models. You know, how do you use multiple models together with heuristics in order to build a solution? And then, you know, unit testing. Like, when do you see that come up in a machine learning course? Almost right. Never. Mm-hmm. And then monitoring a model in production, deploying models with microservices. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I'll be putting a link into our show notes so that anyone else that wants to take this course with me can do so. But it sounds like you are also of the belief that, you know, this is where the field needs to go in terms of actually getting value out of machine learning, kind of thinking about it more holistically.
Yeah, I think so. I think resources like the class you described are really some of the most valuable classes or lessons that everyone can learn right now. Because this comes from a couple of things, which is at Zipcar, at Stripe, and to some extent at Insight as well, you notice that the people that are able to contribute the fastest are sort of the ones that have the appreciation for the whole workflow. In fact, a lot of the times you'll see companies sort of maybe scope out projects for people that are like maybe interning, they're only here for a few months, and those projects are like just training the model, right? It's like they've done everything. Right. They've like thought about the product. They've decided that for this product, this is the model we need. This is the data we have. They've prepared the data. They've decided how they're going to serve the model. And they're like, hey, you know, you're here only for 8 weeks or something. Here's like a model, train it. And so while that's, you know, a fun project, it turns out that if you want to have a meaningful impact, doing all of these other parts is what's going to be most helpful to your career at a larger company, or even if you're building your own startup, right? So just actually getting it out the door.
Yeah, I love that you're only 45 pages into this book before you're into the build your own end-to-end or build your first end-to-end pipeline chapter. Mm-hmm. And that chapter, in the middle of that chapter, is like testing.
Yeah. So there's, at the end of the first chapter, there's also an interview with Monica Rigatti, and she has this great concept that she talks about. She talks about the impact bottleneck. And sometimes, one of the examples she gives is she says, like, well, sometimes your ML might be perfect, but your product is still dead. You're still dead in the water because you've sort of, you know, kind of misunderstood a fundamental need of, like, how your users would actually interact with it. And this is more of maybe, like, a general, you know, software engineering, like, first you should talk to users before you build it. But it's also a good ML tip to say, like, well, you should, as quickly as possible, get to the point where you can show the, like, UI to a friend or a user, have them try it, and then it gives out results, even if you don't have a good model, even if it's a heuristic, just because then you might notice that, like, oh, they're using it in a completely different way than you thought, and that super complicated model that you thought you needed, you actually don't need it at all. You need something else.
Yeah, that's kind of applying the lean startup type of approach, which, you know, I don't even know if it deserves a name or if it has a name, you know, if we need to call it by a name anymore. It's kind of how we do things with MVPs, but it's kind of applying that approach to flesh out some of the, you know, where it's just a bad idea.
Exactly. And I think that approach is, like, more and more valuable as the iteration time goes up, right? So, like, if you don't show it to someone, but it takes you, you know, 50 minutes to build, you've lost 50 minutes. That's okay. But if you don't show it to someone and you need to train a model and get the data and that whole process is going to take you 2 months, then you've lost a lot of time by not doing it.
You know, what I'm curious about is there's, you know, the steps that you need to do to kind of build this sample app. And then there's kind of the broader, you know, things that you need to think about to apply this methodology to your own problems.
Right.
You know, when you're doing things like walking folks through building the end-to-end pipeline for this app or acquiring a data set, like, how do you make sure it's tangible enough that, you know, you're making progress on your example application, but also broad enough that they can take it and run with it?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. It's really hard to think about how you balance that. And in fact, a big part of the reason for having a sample app is to hold myself accountable so that my advice would actually be practical and the methods that I gave were actually true, right? If I tell you something that's actually not going to work, then I'm going to have a hard time demonstrating to you that it works on this toy example.
Yeah.
And so most chapters are structured in a way where I try to give broad, like, this is how you generally look for a data set and try to explore it. It's like, for example, you would generally, like, if you have a current approach, right, because you've built your plan in the previous chapter, and you're saying, well, like, we're gonna use this current approach, trying to think of problems that have sort of the same kind of approach, even if they're in a completely different domain. So maybe you're doing, you know, like, some like reaction prediction for molecules, but maybe that looks just like text translation in a way, right? You're, like, predicting a sequence because of another sequence. You can try to find that first data set, the, like, translation data set, see if your approach works on that, and then change to your current data set. So that's sort of like a general how you do it. And then I illustrate it as an example with, okay, well, for this ML editor thing, this is what we're, like, these are the data sets we're actually going to use. So for most concepts, I try to do both.
The couple of examples or chapters that we've talked about, like, what are the broad principles that folks need to be thinking about when they're building their first pipelines, when they're acquiring their initial data sets?
Yeah. So I think we skipped a little bit over the first section, but I think there's a broad principle in the first section of, like, going from a product to an ML approach that I generally find really valuable and find that, I don't know, I think everybody should do.
Kind of sets the tone for the rest of it, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah. Which is that for the same product goal, you have, again, many ways to do it, many ways to tackle that problem using machine learning. So an example I use is, let's say that you're a retailer and you have an online catalog of items, and you want to help people when they're typing something in the search bar to find the category or the types of items that, you know, they would want to buy. One way to do this, and maybe the simplest way to think about it, is you're like, oh, well, somebody's writing something in the search bar. I'm going to try to like autocomplete the rest of what they're going to say, right? So if they type hands, maybe you autocomplete to like handbag or something, right? A slightly maybe like different approach is they type something and you try to identify which words in their query are relevant to product. So if they're like, I want, you know, a handbag of this brand, like you try to find the name of the brand. And then a third approach that's even simpler is they type anything in that bar, and all you do is you try to like classify it, and like, is it about handbags? Is it about jeans? Is it about, you know, shoes or something else? And those three approaches all would have a slightly different UI, right? You would build sort of the way you show results and the way you show suggestions slightly differently. But they all are basically, each successive approach is like an order of magnitude easier to do than the one before, especially if you don't have much data, right? If you don't have much data, that final approach, building a classifier, is something where you can label data for a few hours and you'll have a classifier that's decent. If you want to do the sort of like knowledge extraction part, that's going to take you maybe a couple of days, but you can probably get something that's pretty good. If you want to go do the full like language model approach of predicting the next tokens, that's going to require a lot of data. And you're also going to have a lot more variance where like sometimes you might predict some crazy things. And unless you have the engineering resources to add that filtering layer on top, that'll make it very hard to ship. And so I think like a question that generally people should ask is like, what is the absolute simplest model in that bucket of model? And I give sort of like a hierarchy of models. What is the simplest model that you could use that could solve what you're currently trying to do? And then if that model's too simple and it's not good enough, it's fine. You can improve on it, but you'll have spent, you know, a couple hours building it instead of a couple months building a model that doesn't work.
And so with that in mind, we go into building the pipeline and acquiring the data set. What are some of the broad principles there?
Yeah. So I think there's this idea that I would say for any data project that you tackle, any new project, you should spend like a couple hours looking at the data. And the couple hours is definitely the minimum time you should spend looking at the data. You could spend a lot more time, that's fine. But you should never spend less than a few hours looking at the data. Looking at the data means a few things. And I found that in my experience at Insight, often people think about it in terms of aggregates, right? They're like, okay, well, you know, I'm looking at this database of like texts. What's the average length of a sentence? Mm-hmm. You know, how many different words are there? And that's fine. And that's something that you should do both to find errors or things that surprise you, where you're like, oh, I was looking at a database of tweets and somehow like all the tweets are one word long. There's probably something wrong. But you should also actually look at individual examples. And that's something that Rob Monroe actually talks about a lot, where a lot of these individual examples will be the source for which model you end up choosing, right? So you have your product goal on one side, you've said like, okay, well, maybe like a classifier is a simple thing I can start with. But then looking at the data will give you your initial set of like features or of like types of model that you think could reasonably capture what you're trying to identify in this data set. And so in the chapter, I go into, well, how can you look at individual examples in a data set? That's hard, right? If you have a data set with like 10,000 examples or 10 million, you're not going to look at all of them. And so there's some methods where you can basically use some like NLP approaches or some approaches from other domains to embed your data. And then once you have this sort of like map of all your data points, you look into each specific sub area and you're like, oh, like this sub area, you know, for me, for the editor example, it was questions on Stack Overflow. So this area of questions, like they all seem to be about, you know, the English language. And so they use a lot of like maybe complex words and they have like longer sentences. Oh, this area, you know, is all about like non-native speakers, that sort of stuff. And so then it helps you like build features where it's like, okay, well, how can I identify a good question in this area or in that area?
Do you have a sense for how you know when you have done enough looking at your data in aggregate or as individual items that you're ready to move on? Is there a feeling or a sense or a checklist or something that beyond just, hey, I've, you know, looking at my watch here, the 2 hours is up,
right?
I can move on to the fun stuff. Like what should you have taken away from that experience?
Yeah, that's something that I think obviously is going to depend on your data set. So you're right. Sometimes it's going to be 2 hours. Sometimes it's maybe going to be 2 days. Sometimes you're going to realize that something's very wrong and you shouldn't move on, right? If you realize that something's off, you should go back to the drawing board and sort of like get another data set or look at why your data is looking all weird. But in the case where you are ready to move on to a model, I'd say that that's when you have a strong hypothesis about how your model will actually do its work. So, you know, if we've talked about like the retailer that like you type queries and then it tells you like, oh, is it a handbag? Is it like something else? Well, if you look at a bunch of examples and you realize that really there's, you know, only two or three ways that people ever say handbag or jeans, that the vocabulary is like pretty simple, that sentences are usually pretty short, you can say like, okay, well, for this approach, like, you know, sort of like a simple bag of words with like word counts will work because I'm reasonably confident that like all I need to know is which of these three words is in the sentence. More generally, I think what I'm trying to say is when you build your first model, you should already have the product goal, that's section one, and then a hypothesis about how your model, like what will make your model succeed. That's like the part two of looking at the data set. Because then once you've trained your model, what you want to do is you want to check your results against your assumption. You want to say like, okay, well, I thought that like because sentences are short, you know, the model would be easily able to pick up on different words. But it turns out that it's not, or it turns out that it's not performing on these. And then you can go back to the data, right, and say like, okay, well, let's look at the examples that my model got wrong. And like, why did it get these wrong? And then make a new hypothesis. And that's the fastest way and generally the best way to iterate, because it'll actually let you understand how your model's working, which once you're ready to deploy it, you'd much rather be like, oh, well, I'm pretty sure that this is how my model's making decisions, rather than like, I trained a model. It got a really high score. I hope everything goes well.
Do you talk about explainability in the context of models? That's something that is getting a lot of attention for folks that are, you know, particularly working in business or enterprise types of environments.
Yeah. This is a topic that gets a lot of attention, a lot of debate. There's generally a few ways to look at explainability. I'd say there's...
And I'm asking primarily from the perspective of having a sense of what your model is doing so that you can better debug it.
Yeah. So there's two parts to that. One part is to have a sense and to debug it, you need to look at like the internals of your model. And then you can look at like its feature importance, its coefficients, that sort of stuff that gives you some sense of explainability. But then there's actually looking at individual data examples or even like multiple data examples, but trends in results on examples, which I think gives you a much better sense of explainability. And what I mean by that is looking at what are the like 10 examples where your, let's say your classifier was the most confident that it was class one, but your classifier was wrong.
Right.
What are the ones where it was most confident of the other class? What are the ones where it was the most unsure? Like looking at those examples and seeing like, oh, you know, it seems like every time there's a question that's 16 sentences long, the model just doesn't know what's going on. It just gives up. That gives you one sense of explainability. And the final sense of explainability that I think a lot of people talk about is black box explainers. So like SHAP values or LIME. And we actually use those pretty heavily in the book because you can use them to power suggestions for your users. So again, the example case study is like something that's going to help you write better. So you give it something you wrote, a question you've wrote, and then we have our model that predicts whether you wrote something basically good or bad for some definition of good or bad. And then we use LIME to say like, oh, you know, we said that this question was like 60% good. These are the features that if you were to change them would push your questions towards the positive class more, right? We're like, okay, well, it seems like, you know, your question's much too long. So if you cut it down, actually, like we would have said that it was much better, that sort of stuff. So you can use explainability to power sort of user-facing suggestions.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is that done commonly? Do you see that a lot?
I see that in a few cases. I think there's no example is perfect, and so the ML editor definitely has a few things where it's like, well, how wildly applicable is that? But out of companies that do that sort of stuff, that do help people write better, I actually have an interview with Chris Harland, who is from Textio, where they do that for general job postings and job communication. And they do mention using sort of similar methods, at least to surface potential features, because they have, whenever you're doing writing recommendations, the real challenge is that you want your users to understand them. And so explainability becomes crucial because, like, if I give you anything and you don't understand why I'm recommending it to you, then you're not going to use my product. And so for a subset of ML products, explainability isn't just a bonus. It's what the product is.
You mentioned Lime. For folks that want to learn more about that, you can check out my 7th interview ever with Carlos Gestrin back in October of 2016. What are some of the other things that come up from a debugging perspective?
I think from the debugging perspective, we end up going back to the iteration loop conversation we had earlier, which is one debugging tip that actually Ross gave me, which you interviewed earlier, and that is used widely at Insight and elsewhere. I've seen it used throughout the industry, is when your model doesn't work, not just when it's when you're not happy with its current score, but when something's not working, you should cut down your data set to one or two examples and then get your model to work. Like, by working, what I mean is just get your model to train and then output predictions. They'll be completely random because you're overfitting on a couple examples. But that alone...
But if you can't do that...
Exactly. Exactly. And so there's sort of... like, that's helped so many fellows and honestly, like, colleagues at previous companies where, like, if every training run takes 4 hours and at the end you have, like, you know, a shape mismatch or something, like, it is the most infuriating process you can go through. Mm-hmm. So
should you just start there, or should you regress there when things aren't working?
I think there's nothing wrong with sort of starting with the Hail Mary of, like, I'm going to write my code. This should work. And then if it doesn't, then I think the first step is going there. Like, if you've written your first training loop and, like, something's very wrong, the first step is, like, okay, you know, you go to your first line and you, like, take X train equals, like, X train period two. Like, you just take a couple examples and then you run it again and you try to get that to work. And in fact, in debugging, I mentioned, like, three steps. The first step is that, which I call debugging the wiring, like making sure that data can go mm-hmm. back and forth. Mm-hmm. Then I think the first step is debugging training performance. Once you've debugged that first aspect, what you want to see is, like, can I overfit on my data set? And so if you take a data set of, like, you know, 2,000 examples, can you train a model so that it becomes very good on this data set? Once more, this model isn't going to be good in production because you've trained it to just be good on data it's already seen. But again, if you can't do that, you're probably not going to be able to train a model that learns general things at all if it can't learn local features. And then finally, you debug generalization. And so these three successive steps are steps that, honestly, I think most program directors at Insight, for example, are very used to, like, helping their fellows walk through each of these steps successfully. But I haven't seen as many resources just sort of, like, outline them. So if you just follow that recipe, usually you'll debug your models much, much faster. It's like the hierarchy of, like, what you should debug in three steps.
What categories of models are covered in the book? Is it, you mentioned TF-IDF, and you also mentioned that you're composing multiple models. Mm-hmm. Are you using both kind of traditional Python models, scikit-learnish, you know, types of models, or are you doing deep learning as well? What's the, you know, portfolio look like?
Mm-hmm. Let me think. How many? We have three models that are used in the main example, and then I'd say, like, probably half a dozen examples of other models as, like, sort of separate from the case study, as, like, this is how you would use VGG to extract features from images, for example. For the main application, the models we use are pretty simple. It starts with a heuristic that's not even a model.
Okay. So you haven't written the BERT version yet?
No, I have not. I have purposefully stayed away from BERT. And that's not to say I have anything against.
Why purposely stay away? Yeah, elaborate on that.
Yeah. No, I don't have anything against sort of, like, more recent approaches. Of course, they're, like, breakthroughs. But I think, one, they're covered enough. I think if you talk to sort of somebody that's either new to the field or even working in NLP and you ask them, like, out of all of the blog posts and research articles and things you've read recently, how many of them were about, like, deep language models? And they'd probably say, like, well, 85%. So I didn't feel like I needed to sort of, like, add my brick onto that cathedral. At the same time, a lot of the advice about building practical applications apply regardless of the model that you use. And so I felt that for readers, it was best if I kept with models that were as simple as possible, because I didn't want to just add complexity for the sake of adding complexity. Like, I think, you know, if you were to use BERT or something more complicated, you could probably get like just a better performance metric on some of these models. But to the point of this book, that's something that you do in iteration number 4, number 5, number 6, number 7. The book shows you the first three iterations, which is one, you build your first stab at a crappy heuristic. Number 2, you build a simple model. Number 3, you build a slightly more complicated model. And number 4, actually, and I guess this is a spoiler alert, but you look at your more complicated model and you realize it's too complicated and you remove some of the useless features to make. So the final model we use in the prototype. But yeah, if I had
so you
a team,
wouldn't be following your own advice if you, you know, jump right into BERT in chapter 2.
Exactly. if somebody wants to write a sequel to this book, I think there's like a lot of room to try BERT and GPT-2 and you know, other more complicated approaches. But I think, yeah, in general, even in industry.
What would that be called? Building more complicated machine learning powered applications?
Yeah, it'd be called, you know, building applications the third year. It's like when you join a team at a company, the first year they're doing this. And then if the team's been around for like 10 years, they're just throwing anything they can at the wall. They're like, oh, let's try BERT. You know, let's try anything.
We didn't cover the feature importance stuff. You spent quite a bit of time on feature importance. How do you see that coming up?
Yeah, I think in this case, right, it was especially useful because we make suggestions for users based on the features of our
model. So that application specific as opposed to a general step in the process?
Good question. So feature importance is a step for debugging where, especially if you're using a model that has many features, either because it's a deep learning model and it just does its own feature generation, or you know, you just have like a tabular data set with thousands of features. Looking at feature importance can help you check the assumptions that we talked about. Meaning, like, you've made assumptions, you said, like, well, because length of a question is important, it'll be an important feature. And then you look at your features and it's not, you know, it's like the importance is zero, then your assumption was wrong. And so as part of your iteration cycle, looking at feature importance is really valuable. The specific chapter you're talking about, which is using feature importance to make recommendations, I would say is the only chapter in the whole book that's very, very specific to the ML editor. It was actually reviewers of the book said, like, the book is great, but I feel like we should have a deep dive into the sort of like ML editor at some point that like wraps things up. And so this is the book's attempt at that, of like, okay, well, let's take everything together and actually get the ML editor to like a ready product.
And then the last part of the book goes into deployment and monitoring. What are the key takeaways there?
Yeah. So there's like three main aspects that are covered there. One is the ethics of deployment and the things that you should think about when you deploy ML models. This chapter is mostly about resources that I share. There's actually an excellent free O'Reilly book about data ethics that I link to in this chapter. And there's a big body of work, but I try to just give some aspects that you might want to think about based on recent research. Then the other two aspects are just, what is the engineering work around models, both as you deploy them and once you've deployed them? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of takeaways from the engineering work are, for most complicated models, so like think famously the Google Smart Reply. So Google Smart Reply is you get an email and they suggest those three responses that you could use. Not the new version where you press tab and it just auto-completes, the one where it like just suggests responses you can just click on. That model is a relatively complicated model. And because of that, it fails on a non-zero number of emails. And so before running that model, they have what's called a filtering model, which is a much simpler model, which the goal of that model is to say, like, should we run our model or not? And so I cover like tricks like these tricks, right? For example, like, when should you decide that it's worthwhile to build a first model that's like a much simpler one that will save you compute time and save you from showing ridiculous results to your users if like this input is not suited for your complex model? Mm-hmm. And then the last chapter goes into sort of like CI, CD, and monitoring for ML and like what you can look at when you're like A/B testing or when you're putting a new model in production. A lot of companies have started doing what's called like shadow deployments, where like you put a model into shadow, which means that it's just like a real model, except that you don't actually use what it produces, but that's right. Sort of like final way to test it.
Yeah, nice. And so what's the, you know, I referred back to the TwinWorks AI Platforms conference and some of the writing that I've been doing on AI ML platforms and kind of open source and commercial products that like enable you to build out these workflows and kind of manage these workflows for you. I'm assuming that you're not like building all of this in one of those environments. How are you like stringing together the pieces that you're doing? Is it all kind of standard vanilla Python, or are you building on vanilla Python and using any particular kind of approach to make this modular, or are you worried about that? You know, how are you pulling this, all these workflow components together?
I mean, there is a world where, you know, in like a few years, something comes out, which is like the TensorFlow, but just for all of machine learning, maybe it'll be TensorFlow. And mm-hmm. this is all obsolete, where people are just like, well, you could just, you know, like write one line of this sort of new framework. I'm willing to take that risk. In the current state, I feel like while there's many useful tools, it wouldn't necessarily be what readers are looking for. Like, they're not necessarily looking to learn how to use Kubeflow or you know, how to use Airflow for sort of scheduling DAGs. So I kept things pretty lightweight, where most of it is in raw Python. You know, there's simple unit testing, Jupyter notebooks to illustrate concepts. And then for the serving side, built a simple Flask app with some examples of like how you'd cache requests. And that, I think, serves the purposes of the book well. Whenever possible, I've added sort of links to resources where it's like, well, if you want to know more about how you would, for example, build models on device, like you might want to check out this resource. Mm-hmm. But for the actual code examples, again, I wanted to, because the book already has the tall order of covering all of machine learning, I felt like I wanted to yeah. keep it pretty focused.
Cool. So when should we expect the, you know, volume 2, second edition, your next book?
After a long vacation. But yeah, I mean, depending on how well this book goes, it was actually a really enjoyable process to write it with O'Reilly. The process of writing a book, you know, I would recommend to no one. That's horrible. But O'Reilly made it as unhorrible as possible. So
nice. Awesome. Well, Emmanuel, it was great catching up with you. Congratulations on getting this book published. We've been chatting about it for a bit, at least conceptually, you know, mm-hmm. that it was something that you're laboring under. And I'm super excited to, you know, see it, have an opportunity to hold it in my hand and chat with you about it on the show.
Awesome. Thank you, Sam.
All right. Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about Emmanuel or his new book, visit twimmelai.com/talk/349. For more information on the AI Enterprise Workflow Study Group, visit twimmelai.com/AIEW. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, we would be very grateful if you subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. All right, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.